You know, I don't know, you sometimes my wife and I will take moments, maybe it's like around a birthday celebration or anniversary, to do a little bit of reflection on our journey together in marriage and in our family. And just a couple weeks ago, we found ourselves just kind of going through the sort of story of our marriage. And we were like, man, we've made it through some stuff. And I was remembering back to very early on in our marriage, like first year of marriage. I was teaching full-time at a Christian school. I think my very, very illustrious salary was something in the neighborhood of like $26,000 a year. You know, it wasn't making a ton of money. And I remember, you know, it was really hard in those first couple of years, not having a lot of money. I'm also on top of teaching. I was like traveling around the country doing itinerant ministry. And then I was doing some coaching and other things on the side just to make ends meet. And I remember we were in this pretty small, like two-bedroom townhome. Carrie was pregnant with Justice. And I remember saying to her this number. I was like, if we make it to this number in income, I think everything is going to be all right. Like, everything will be fixed. The world will work as it should. And I wrote down this number and I put it on a refrigerator. Several years passed, you know, we're still working hard and we hit that number. And guess what? Some of you know how this is going already. All the troubles didn't magically disappear. I found myself with a new set of troubles, new bills, new expenses, new children on the way. And so I would continue to take on, you know, odd jobs here and there just to try to make ends meet, thinking that as soon as we get to this next number, everything is going to be all right. One of the weird odd jobs I found myself doing, there's a longer story behind this, and I can tell you more about it another time. But one odd job I found myself doing was, I don't know how this happened, we had some friend of a friend of a friend that worked for Minnesota's probably most famous music icon, the artist here formerly known as Prince. And I got a picture here, if I can turn this on. There we go. I'm sure most of you know Prince, right? There he is, at probably the best Super Bowl halftime performance of all time, if you care about such things. I found myself invited to work at Prince's house. This was before Prince had passed away. And it was a very, very strange encounter. It was, again, friend of a friend of a friend that was Prince's manager. And he knew I had experience in like music and audio. And he was like, hey, we always have this situation where Prince will fly in from LA. And at the very last minute, he'd tell us like, hey, I need the studio set up, or I need this room set up for a party, and I need all this audio equipment. He's like, I'm always struggling at the last minute. And my wife had the brilliant idea. She said, well, my husband knows some stuff about that. Maybe he could help you. And I was like, well, yeah, sure. I never made anything of it. And then one night I got a call. It's like, hey, I'm in a pinch here. Would you come over to Prince's house and help me set up his studio? So I was like, yeah, sure, cool. I didn't know Prince was actually there at the time. So I walk in the door. It's such a weird, like this feels like a surreal dream. I walk in the door. I'm greeted by Prince's personal chef, who is, he's like, hey, I need your help right away with something. I was like, yeah, sure. He hops on this forklift and there's like the kind of Purple Rain motorcycle from the movie Purple Rain that's sitting over in the corner. He's like, would you climb up on this ledge? It's about 15 feet tall. And would you help me get this Purple Rain motorcycle next to this large metallic silver horse? And I was like, yeah, sure. Why? He's like, we don't ask why around here. I was like, sure. So I climb up and do that. And then we get the boot out of this, I don't know if you'd call it a living room. I don't know what you would call it. It had this big movie theater screen in it. We get booted out of that room because the chef comes out. It's just me, the chef, the personal assistant, and like this random 18-year-old kid from LA that Prince had given a job to who was down on his luck. So I'm in this room. They're like, hey, you got to go. Prince is going to come in and have dinner. And I asked the chef, like, what are you making him for dinner? I'm expecting some, you know, lavish kind of spoon and stable sort of thing. He's like, just a personal pizza. I was like, oh, that's it, okay. So we got booted out of the room as Prince came in and ate his pizza and watched this Spanish opera DVD, this totally true story by himself. And the whole time I'm wondering, oh, I don't know if I'm ever actually going to meet him here tonight. So we go back to one of the warehouses, and it is filled with the most expensive musical instruments and gear, an entire warehouse, all the old tour posters, all of the merchandise from the past. It is filled. I mean, the most expensive guitars and amplifiers. I'm kind of in heaven walking around here. Finally, we make our way back. He's done eating. We start loading some equipment into this room. And then I'm loading some stuff up, and then all of a sudden, like, the two other guys that are working around me kind of have a hush. I look over in the corner, and Prince has walked in the room. Now, I don't get starstruck real easily. I don't have this, like, weird celebrity thing that I go to, but I was a little bit starstruck in the company of Prince. One of the things that caught me right away was, this was several years before he passed, was, boy, he looks really, really frail. Like, he doesn't look like, and he was walking with a limp. He was not in a good condition. I don't mean this to, I don't say this to be mean at all, but he looked a lot like my grandmother, who was in her 90s at the time. He looked really, really frail. So for the next, like, couple hours, this is true story, Prince never said a word to me. This is me and, like, three other people along with Prince in this room here. Never said a word directly to me. But here's what he did. He mediated through his personal assistant. We had these big, massive purple sectional couches. I'm wearing my purple jacket today for Prince. These massive purple sectional couches that he would just say, mediated through his personal assistant. Personal assistant would say, Prince would like you guys to move those couches 5 steps that way. Picked it up, moved it. He wants them 10 feet that way. And over again for like 2 hours, we did this. Finally, the starstruck thing wore off. And I'm like, this is not a job I want to continue doing. But you know what? It really stood out to me that night was I was in the company of royalty, right? And this man was hobbled. He needed a hip replacement. He was not in good condition. Prince had been divorced twice. I didn't find this out till after, but the only child Prince had, the only child that he had fathered died 6 days after the child was born. And Prince himself died at the age of 57 due to an accidental drug overdose of fentanyl. At the time, Prince's net worth was $200 million. Here I am thinking all I needed was to make a little bit more money, and here I am in the company of somebody who has more than he could ever need, and I don't think I would have traded my life for his. You know, we all have this innate sense that the world isn't as it should be, and we long to fix that, but we don't always know how to fix it and what fixing it even looks like. In today's message, we're going to continue to look at the Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to address the ageless temptation that people throughout time and culture have been tempted to believe that simply by accumulating more money and possessions, we will somehow be able to set right our lives and make everything whole. We're going to see that from Jesus' perspective, this is an illusory lie. So if you'd open up your Bibles to Matthew chapter 6, we're going to look at verses 19 to 34 this morning. Matthew chapter 6. You know, a few weeks ago when we launched into this Sermon on the Mount section of Matthew's gospel, I kind of compared the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus' Beatitudes to Jesus' manifesto, where Jesus presents his followers with this vision for what the world will look like when God ultimately has his way. Jesus acknowledges that we are feeling that there's this gap between the way the world is now and the way it should be is real, and that it isn't currently functioning as it should be. Jesus' proposal throughout the Sermon on the Mount is that the way that the world should be, or what Matthew calls the kingdom of heaven, that is brought about by Christ, through Christ, and in him. But how we move from the current dysfunction that we experience to the perfect setting right of his kingdom is something that we don't always like to confront. The transformation of that outer world, the world outside of us, doesn't come about primarily through us working to overthrow governments or to rage against the machine or to rebel against the system. That transformation of the outer world starts with the transformation of our inner world as we follow Jesus' way. And in following his way, we've learned so far that following in the way of Jesus produces the virtues of Jesus, produces the character of Jesus. And this all seems simple enough, right? If we follow Jesus' way, it changes our character. But sometimes we realize, as we're going to see today, that some things that Jesus says, this isn't right, it needs to be set right in you, sometimes deep down, we start to recognize we might actually kind of like the dysfunction in some weird and twisted way. Or even if we don't like it, it seems like to trust Jesus would be so hard to do. So let's start in this section of Matthew's Gospel and the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to start off by looking at verses 19 through 21. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. You know, sometimes as we've gone through Matthew's gospel, we start to realize that there is this pretty stark difference between the culture and context of that ancient world in the first century and the world we live in today. And so sometimes some of Jesus' sayings can be hard to get. This is not one of those. You know, this is not one of those. This is an ageless temptation. Throughout time, throughout culture, throughout history, humans have always struggled with the temptation, this idea that if we can acquire enough material wealth and treasure, we would be able to secure a perfect future for ourselves. We'd be able to secure enough power, enough influence. If we get to that threshold, then things would be set right. It's an ageless temptation. You know, one of my favorite illustrations of this timeless temptation comes from J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. In The Hobbit, how many of you have read The Hobbit or at least seen, you know, the cartoon or the movie before? Okay. So in The Hobbit, you've got this Bilbo Baggins who is on a quest with a wizard Gandalf and a band of dwarves to reclaim the dwarves' lost treasure. And inside the Lonely Mountain, there is a giant dragon named Smaug. Smaug is not just only the protector of the treasure, but he is the symbolic picture of greed itself. Despite lying on mountains of treasure, this dragon is never satisfied, and he is perpetually afraid of losing the treasure. He does nothing of good with all of the treasure that he has been sitting on. He only hoards it. And he has actually laid on this treasure so long that the patches of his scales on his chest have been rubbed bare, which end up exposing a weak spot. And if you know the story, you know that Bilbo flatters the dragon and gets the dragon to show off, which exposes the weak spot in his scales. Later, that weak spot becomes the downfall of Smaug, and he's defeated by a bowman who pierces the weak spot with an arrow. Now, the dwarves get the mountain back, right? And the king of the dwarves, or who should be king of the dwarves, Thorin Oakenshield, he's now reclaimed his material wealth, but what ends up happening to Thorin? He begins to develop what Tolkien fans call the dragon sickness himself. The treasure corrupts his heart too. And he becomes consumed with greed and paranoia just like the dragon. What he longed to possess has now possessed him. It's the same warning we see in stories like this over and over, the warning of Jesus that for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Let's pick up here in verse 22. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. In the beginning of this section, it's kind of a strange expression. The eye is the lamp of the body, but we have something maybe similar to that in our modern vernacular. You might hear people say something like, the eyes are the window to the soul. What we give our attention to isn't just a reflection of our deepest values, but it shapes our values. The warning here from Jesus seems like enigmatic, But it's deeply connected to everything else in this particular section, the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus' warning is this: attention shapes our allegiance. What we give our attention to shapes our allegiances. It shapes who we place our trust in as master. You know, many of you know this already, but I didn't grow up in the Twin Cities. I grew up in the Metro Detroit area. And so when football season comes around, people are always asking me, are you more of a Lions fan than a Vikings fan? And, you know, the strange thing happened to me, and I realized it around like the 2009-2010 Vikings season, where they made it all the way to that NFC Championship game against the Saints. And this really weird thing happened to me as I was watching that Vikings-Saints game. I was in the middle of the game, and I found myself in front of my TV. I don't even think carrying the kids were on. I'm in a room by myself, and I am up on my feet yelling at the TV screen after a bad call that went against the Vikings, and it suddenly hit me. Oh my goodness, I think I've become a Vikings fan. How did that happen? How did that happen? Well, you know, I started to realize. All right, it was 2010 when that game happened. I moved here in 2006. I had spent 4 years of every Sunday watching Vikings games. When I turned on sports radio on my drive to work, they weren't talking about the Lions, they were talking about the Vikings. And when I talked with people at work or at church about, hey, you know, talk about football, right? We do this all the time. They were talking about the Vikings. Guess what happened? What I gave my attention to reshaped my allegiances. Now, yes, I'm still a Lions fan, but I found that even without any effort at all, I hadn't made a conscious decision to be like, I want to become a Vikings fan. What I had given my attention to had shaped my allegiances. Through regular practice and ritual, my allegiances began to change. There's a reason why we have this expression called paying attention. Did you pay attention? Because attention always costs us something. Jesus warns of a grave danger when we pay too much attention to treasure, money, and possessions, because what happens is they become a rival to God for our allegiance. And frankly, this is probably an even more grave danger for us today than it was for Jesus' original audience in Matthew's gospel. By our standards today, the majority of this original audience is living in abject poverty. Now, we've got this really difficult predicament in our day and age where our attention is being harvested all the time. You know, we have giant tech companies that specifically employ psychologists for the express purpose of figuring out how to best harvest our attention to sell us stuff through ads. So if you use Google, you're getting this experience. If you use YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, or X, you're getting this sort of psychological programming. All of these companies have figured out how to use things called variable reward systems, similar to slot machines, right? Dopamine-driven feedback loops, and they know how to prey on our FOMO, which is fear of missing out, to keep us constantly scrolling and interacting. All of this attention, we have to be aware, because this is a brand new phenomenon in human history. All of this attention is shaping your allegiances. And I'm not proposing that Christ calls us definitively to unplug from the internet or, you know, don't be on social media at all. You know, the same roads the ancient Romans built to get their military across Europe and Asia is the same roads that the apostles traversed to get the gospels to the nations. So I'm not saying the remedy here is we just unplug from everything. But what I am suggesting is that in this unprecedented time in culture and history, that we should be keenly aware that our allegiances can very easily be diverted away from the eternal God, who is the fount of all that is true, good, and beautiful, and can be given to temporary idols of money, possessions, and the status that we believe is going to get us what we ultimately want. Either, what did Jesus say? Either you will hate one or love the other. You know, it's like what Bob Dylan used to sing, right? You're gonna serve somebody, right? There's somebody we're going to serve. The fruit of serving these temporary idols, I just need a little bit more status. I need a little bit more money. I need a few more possessions. The fruit of serving these temporary idols is not a wholeness of life. but a constant sense of perpetual worry and anxiety. And this is plaguing our culture. I want to show you some things that are a little bit disturbing. Since the rise of smartphones, look at how anxiety has drastically increased across all age groups except for those 50 and over. Way to go. If you're 50 and over, you're doing all right. Everyone else, oh boy. 18 to 25, since 2008 when the iPhone came out, anxiety has increased 139%. I'm sorry, since 2010. 16 to 34, 103%. 35 to 49, 52%. What in the world is going on? Not only that, but over time, our happiness is declining. Since 1972, Americans have been perpetually less happy with a very, very sharp decline. When? Right around 2010, when we started putting these things in front of our faces all the time. Why? What is it doing in us? You know, there's a strong argument to be made by social psychologists like Jonathan Haidt that there's this direct connection between the advent of the smartphone, the rise of social media, and the increase of our constant sense of anxiety. And there's a lot of reasons for this, including the way those algorithms that have been designed by psychologists to exploit our reward systems might be messing with our dopamine levels. But we can't be quick to rule out that the constant barrage of images, words, and sounds that are always trying to sell us something are shaping us to serve a master that does not give us life to the fullest. And one of the fruits of our allegiance to this master who does not give us wholeness of life is that we are perpetually worried, perpetually feeling empty and burned out. I'm not making this up. Jesus makes this direct correlation. He's not talking directly maybe about all the ads we're consuming every time we scroll every three posts on Instagram, but he is talking about this direct connection between we place our trust in material possessions and status, we place our trust in gaining more and more and more, and we think it's going to set us right. But look at what Jesus says next. He warns them, "Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your clothes, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not more valuable than they? Can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which are here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For pagans run after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Jesus' original audience here is comprised primarily of subsistence farmers, fishermen, day laborers, we might call them today the working poor. Roman historians estimate that the average annual income for someone in this class of day laborers was approximately $3,000 to $5,000 a year, with no savings, certainly no health care, no retirement. If Jesus is telling them, don't worry about what you will eat, your clothes, your possessions, what do you think he would say to us today? This isn't an indictment on, making enough money to care for your family. It's not an indictment on making enough money so that you could give money away. No, This isn't like a don't open the savings account or anything like that. I mean, the Apostle Paul even says in 1 Timothy 5:8 that anyone who does not provide for their relatives, and especially for their own household, has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So this isn't like don't be wise with money, don't get a job, don't work. This isn't that. What Jesus is addressing here is where we place our allegiance and trust. And he compares the disposition of being constantly worried, constantly what we might call today feeling burned out, to what pagans feel. Why? Because at the heart of ancient paganism was this drive to figure out, what do you need to do to be in control of the world? Most of the ancient pagan cultures around the ancient Israelites had assigned deities to the forces of nature that seemed to be outside of human control. So you had gods for the sky, for the rain, gods for rivers and fertility. Most of these pagan religions in the ancient world didn't believe that these gods actually cared about them at all. They didn't care about you. They just knew that there was some powerful force beyond them that must be in control of the seemingly uncontrollable. And so there has to be some way to appease them and make them happy so that you could gain control over your life. Has there been a famine or drought in your land? Well, what do you need to do to sacrifice to appease the gods of land and sky so that you could get the outcome that you want? But here's the thing that the pagans always wrestled with. Because the pagan deities didn't actually care for you, you had no idea whether your continual sacrifices to them would ever appease them and would ever give you control over your life. So you lived in a constant state of worry and anxiety. But if the pagans have an unconcerned, impersonal deity, notice what Jesus says his followers have. You have a heavenly Father. That's totally different. I don't know. You might feel like, well, I don't have idols in my house and I'm not tempted to ancient paganism, but in many ways, our temptations are still the same. We look to temporary idols to appease eternal desires in us. Paganism at its core is about manipulating outcomes to try and control the world. Jesus calls us to something totally different. He calls us to simply do what is right and entrust the outcomes to God, a God who is our Father. Just do what's right. Seek first the kingdom and righteousness. What is righteousness? Doing what is right, living in the way of Jesus, bringing about that kingdom that is to come in the here and now. When we do that, we can entrust the outcomes to God. So here's like the trade-off, right? Okay, you can live in a constant state of trying to control the world and manipulating all of the outcomes to your ends like pagans do, or Jesus presents an alternative. Consider the sparrow and the lilies of the field. They're sufficiently fed and clothed, aren't they? And guess what? They're free of worry. You know, is life free of hardship for a bird? No. This isn't like a weird like prosperity gospel thing where it's like, consider the birds. They never have worries or concerns at all. You know, everything is always all right. But guess what? The lesson I learned in being around the company of Prince that night is that hardship might hit you whether you have $200 million or whether you have not a single penny to your name. Corrie ten Boom, who was a Dutch follower of Jesus that helped numbers of Jews escaped the Nazis during World War II, once wrote that, quote, worry does not empty tomorrow of its sorrow, it empties today of its strength. So we can live in a perpetual state of worry, and guess what? Jesus says it's not going to even add a single inch to your height. The worry doesn't change anything. So what does Christ call us to do? It's not to try to control the world. We can't control the world. We can be faithful and entrust in a faithful God. So where will we place our trust? In this last song, I'm going to invite the worship team to come back up. In this last song, I want to invite you to do something here as a practice. Obviously, we will all be singing the same words together, which is a prayer about entrusting our lives into the care of our loving Father. But here's what I want you to do. There's like instrumental sections of the song where we don't sing anything. And here's what I want to invite you to do. We're going to be singing specifically a prayer that says, God, I recognize my worth is not in what I own. My worth is not in this. It's not in that. And so what I'd invite you to do, because this is actually really, really hard to trust. I told my wife and kids this week, oh man, I'm not looking forward to this sermon because this is one of those ones that I don't feel like I've mastered well. I don't feel like I've like got this one down. I'm preaching to myself this morning. But one of the things I would invite you to do in those little instrumental sections is to simply tell God, here is the thing I'm most afraid of if I were to trust you. It might be like, God, if I trust you and I give my trust to you, I'm concerned where my next paycheck might come from. I'm concerned I might not be able to retire comfortably. I'm concerned about where my health care will come from. I'm concerned about this. I'm concerned about that. Whatever that fear may be, in those instrumental sections where we're not singing everything all together, just under your breath, just say, God, I'm afraid of this, and I want to trust you with it. Will you do that with me? Let's all stand and let's sing together.